Hearing.
You have a special letter plastered in front.
House Committee on Revenue for February 27th, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to take the agenda slightly out of order because we have people who were here on Thursday and are ready to be heard. We're going to open the public hearings on House Bill 2063 and House Bill 2770, and we'll continue the public hearing. Kyle can give us the briefest of reminders of what the bill's about, and then and if I get the witness list, I'll be able to call witnesses.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And I guess just as a note for the people that are signing up, we don't have the same list from the previous, from last week.
Right, so should be the ones who are here wanting to testify today.
Yes. Yeah,
so anybody who was here last week and hasn't signed up, we need to know that so we can get you on the list.
Okay, I believe they're coming up now. So, yes, House Bill, we have 2770, 2063, we're both relating to the, for lack of a better term, the gigabit property tax exemption. So it's an exemption that's available to essentially assess communication companies that build, maintain, and operate a qualified project, and that's related to the gigabit symmetrical service. And just as a reminder, a couple notes I made. During the discussions, I believe this was on Thursday, an important point to keep in mind was the gigabit exemption came into being really through Senate Bill 611 in 2015, but there were a number of other exemptions and even some base definitional changes contained in that bill. The bills 2770 and 2063 relate to the gigabit exemption. They do not affect the other parts of the exemptions that are in there, and it isn't probably important to stress that one of the other pieces of the exemption was the historic cost times 130%, so in effect an overall cap in some ways for qualified companies related to their intangibles. And there's also the exemption for franchises and satellites, which is an intangible value. Those exemptions are going forward, and companies are able to take part of those. So there are revenue impacts. Those are in the tax expenditure report, the governor's tax expenditure report. So just, I know there was some testimony saying no one's receiving an exemption under 611. That's related to the gigabit portion of it. But there are companies that are receiving exemption under the other components.
Right.
So just to stress that.
Right. And now the 130% rule, is that in addition to exemptions on the other bases, or is it instead of?
It's instead of, Mr. Chair. And that's it's a relatively small revenue impact. I think it's going to $1 million in 2017-19. Mm-hmm. Part of that is the fact that there are the FCC licenses, franchises,
right,
exemptions. If you did away with one of those, you might see the historic cost use go up.
So the company gets to choose which one it wants, is that right?
They take the one that's most advantageous for them.
Right, okay. So those who don't have one of those first three things could pick the 130% to reduce their potential liability.
That's correct.
Okay,
yes.
All right. Thank you. We have four witnesses who signed up again this week. I think they're the same people who were on the list last week. Skip Newberry and Joni Deutsch first. And on deck, Jody Weiser and Marcia Kelly. Welcome. Thank you for being here today.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Skip Newberry. I'm president and CEO of the Technology Association of Oregon. We represent about 430 tech companies throughout Oregon. We have offices in Portland, Bend, and Eugene. And today I'm providing testimony with respect to HB 2770 and 2063. We have concerns about including tech intangibles as part of central assessment in Oregon and the removal of the gig exemption in particular. Wireless technologies fundamentally depend on fiber, and where companies are providing new wireless technologies, they're relying in part on existing fiber infrastructure. The cost of deploying fiber today is just as expensive as it was a couple of years ago in 2015. And as Silicon Valley and the Bay Area become less desirable to tech companies, we're seeing a mass exodus of both companies as well as talent coming up to places like Oregon. And they're coming up here because places like Silicon Valley are becoming increasingly unaffordable in terms of housing, increasing costs of doing business. And so our ability to remain competitive in this battle for talent and for companies is premised on a number of factors. And the availability of top-notch fiber, wireless, and communications infrastructure is key among them. We recently commissioned a study from IHS Markit that looked at the economic impact of Oregon's tech industry on the state's economy. And the report included an analysis of the tax systems and policies across five western states that were often competing for talent, companies, and investments in infrastructure with. And those states include Washington, Utah, Arizona, Colorado, and Texas. One of the recommendations made by the IHS report was to reform the property tax practice of central assessment of technology intangibles, as in Arizona, remove intangibles from the unit valuation of assets subject to property tax. So uncertainty regarding central assessment in Oregon and the inclusion of intangibles is making Oregon less competitive in attracting investments in technology infrastructure. And the issue, I guess, is that we cannot afford to lose ground further. Oregon ranks 15th currently in high-speed broadband nationally, and Oregon lags behind Washington, which is ranked first, and California, which is ranked second. And notably, a recent National Conference of State Legislatures report on taxation observed that the old rate regulated telecommunications company is a thing of the past. As noted earlier in testimony from last week, technology is changing very rapidly, and that fact points to a certain clunkiness in trying to apply a mechanism, central assessment, that was designed to focus on tangible assets to intangible assets. The NCSL report goes on to say that today, companies providing advanced telecommunication services have no regulatory mechanism that provides a guaranteed rate of return on investment, as railroads did under the original version of central assessment. And for that reason, states like Washington, Texas, and Utah all exempt tech intangibles from central assessment with varying degrees of success. So many of them do have some forms of exemptions that they offer. The other concern that we have with the proposed bills, I think, was covered extensively on Thursday, which was just the fairness issue about essentially moving goalposts too soon as companies are preparing to look at investments which are inherently long-term and expensive. So I'm not going to belabor that point, and I'll just conclude there. Thanks for your consideration.
Thank you very much. And it would be useful, given the detail in yep. what you've testified to, if you could provide that in writing for us.
Happy to.
Thank you very Thanks. Much. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barhart, members of the committee. Apologize, my voice kind of went out a little bit earlier today. Joni Deutsch, Executive Director for the Northwest with TechNet. TechNet represents over 70 of the nation's leading companies in the fields of information technology, internet media, venture capital, and green tech. We are the national bipartisan network of technology companies that promotes the growth of the innovation economy. We feel Oregon should be commended on creating policy that incentivizes telecommunications companies in making expensive upgrades to their networks that will support the cities and economies of tomorrow. With technology such as driverless cars and the Internet of Things on the horizon, high-speed gigabyte service will soon be a necessity. It will be the basic infrastructure on which smart cities are built upon. These are the cities that will leverage technology to improve education, tackle environmental challenges, and move people around more safely and efficiently than ever before. By utilizing the Internet of Things and gigabyte internet speeds, local municipalities will be able to tackle all of today's challenges in ways that are limited only by the imagination. Unfortunately, House Bill 2063 and House Bill 2770 will slow down, if not stop, the progress that has been made in moving towards that future. Having build-out requirements on minimum investments along with price regulations will create an anti-competitive environment. Worse, incumbent carriers may choose to strengthen their networks and utilize new technologies in other states that have a friendlier business climate, where their investments will be taxed at a more moderate rate. On this note, fiber optic and high-speed broadband networks are very expensive to build and maintain and require constant investment. Additionally, telecommunications companies have already pay a higher than average amount of taxes due to the variety of fees, franchise fees, and surcharges that are unique to the industry, in combination with property and income taxes in Oregon. By adding intangible asset into the tax roll, this can double or triple a telecommunications company already expensive tax bill. That said, based on legislation from 2015, the Oregon legislature signaled it understands the need for high-speed internet and the challenges telecommunications companies and data centers face in Oregon. If House Bill 2063 is an attempt to further refine prior legislation, there are some mechanical flaws that should be addressed. Minimum investment requirements are difficult to scale across industry, as each company's network is different in size and scope. Price regulations are problematic as they disrupt supply and demand market forces. Additionally, if the price is not regulated in accordance with the investment requirements and the companies cannot be profitable, then they will choose to not make investments in their networks or at least not prioritize Oregon as a place to build out. Finally, moving the goalpost one session later after companies have invested and applied for the exemption creates an unpredictable climate for business. Business need to feel secure that their long-term investments will be honored so they can plan accordingly. This is a dangerous precedent to set for industry, changing the rules of engagement not more than one session later. Instead of going backwards, Oregon should continue to build upon 2015's Senate Bill 611, which incentivized companies to make the heavy investment in infrastructure that will be needed in the not-so-distant future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It would be helpful if you would provide your testimony in writing, and in addition to that, provide the background data to substantiate the position you've taken on the cost of these systems, the tax comments that you made, as a comparison with Oregon and other states where your companies do business, the kinds of questions that I asked others about last week. And as we do these kinds of things, we need to the comparisons that compare total taxes to total taxes. Otherwise, it isn't a useful exercise. I appreciate that very much. Representative Nose, please.
Okay. I have two questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The first question, and maybe either one of you could answer it, is who wants or needs this kind of high gigabyte service? Who's the audience or the customer base that's looking for this?
Sure. So Representative Nose and Chair and members of the committee, so a lot of the companies that we work with are the users of high-speed gigabit fiber and bandwidth and wireless services. We have companies that range from companies that are doing video game development to processing large amounts of data that are it's being thrown off of sensor networks. So as infrastructure increasingly has more environmental sensors that are collecting data, you have more data that needs to be processed, whether that's smart transportation, smart buildings, environmental sensors, you name it. There's a number of companies that are also doing work in terms of census data for political research. I mean, hospitals, it really keeps going down the list. You think of an industry vertical, there's a company focusing on big data related processing and applications associated with it. And with that fiber infrastructure, a case in point is just in our Eugene office, there's an initiative underway to connect into better middle mile infrastructure and also focus on ways to provide more gigabit investment, incentivize more gigabit investment and beyond, given the number of companies that are there in education tech, video game development, and then processing large amounts of data just in the software side of it okay. alone.
All right, so that helps me understand who's benefiting from it or who's looking for it. One more question.
Please, yeah.
All right, so my memory of Senate Bill 611 was that we were trying to rationalize our central assessment process when it came to intangibles, and that's why we put in the caps that we did, because I remember seeing graphs and charts that showed that our tax situation would be tremendous relative to what others pay. All right, so this gigabyte thing feels like a separate thing from that in my mind. I hope I'm processing this correctly. Why does your industry, or why do folks that want to do this need a tax subsidy to be able to do it? I understand the part about our intangible taxation was the most aggressive among the 50 states or hard to manage. Okay, that I understand rationalizing that or changing that, but like, why is the subsidy needed to do this?
I think the point that I was making about reference to some of the reports that had recommended intangibles, that the inherent challenge there is that intangibles are difficult to assess. And so if you were able to take intangibles out of the central assessment thing, that would be ideal. But if you're going to include intangibles, as some states do, looking at different ways to mitigate or offset that impact. And so whether it's an incentive scheme or some sort of an exemption, those are all different tools in the toolbox that different states have looked at, including Oregon.
One more follow-up.
Please, yes.
All right, so Is it a question of foregoing taxes that we might collect, or is it a question of somebody's going to be out $2.5 million or $2 million, whatever it was that Frontier intimated, or $167 million in some budget that they were planning on? Do you see where I'm at? Like if we please don't take this as this is what I'm willing to do at this point, but
right.
It's, okay,
hypothetical.
But like, if we make this whole, or we don't change this, are we just not collecting $167 million or $2 million, or are we out that? Like, we've already, that's already been promised, and we're taking it from you and giving it to that local government. Do you, you understand what I'm asking?
So, in other words, like, how do you assess the harm?
Yes.
Okay. I think I get it. So Representative Nost, Chair, members of the committee, as I understand it, the question is, you know, if we were to change the approach here, is the harm essentially the companies that have already invested, or is there some forward-looking?
Or these various local governments that are counting on a certain amount of revenue, are they going to be out that? That's what I'm not understanding.
Right. So that I don't have enough information to answer.
Okay.
Yep. But thank you.
Representative Smith Warner, and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to comment briefly on my colleague's question or thought process, which is I think we're all trying to get to the same place, and I would argue that the premise is that there were at least two companies that invested in this infrastructure. If they do not then get exempted from central assessment for that, they will still have that infrastructure that they built and still be, because they also built it because the premise was that they could serve their customers with this infrastructure. And I know that you guys aren't either one of them, so I apologize for that I'm saying this to you, even though you are not them. But my read is, so they invested that money in the infrastructure. The infrastructure still exists. They are still able to offer that service to their customers. What our decision here will do or not do, it will impact the amount, the way they are assessed, and therefore the amount of taxes that both the state and the localities get based on their overall assessment. They either will be exempted from the central assessment, which will dramatically reduce their assessments, or they will continue to be centrally assessed.
Well, let me just say they would be centrally assessed in either case. The difference is what portion of their intangible property would be considered in the value of the company for the purpose of property taxes.
Okay. Yeah.
And of course, it varies between different businesses. It will have different impacts on based on what that intangible value is. Some of these companies don't have much intangible value, and therefore doesn't affect them very much. Others have a lot, and it may affect them more. Of course, we put the caps on that Kyle described last time, precisely to deal with those companies for whom the intangibles are ginormous, and the physical assets in the ground aren't as big, in order to deal with the issue of overtaxation. I don't know if that's a helpful response to your comment or not, but that's what we were dealing with. If you weren't involved in the debate last time, I certainly understand why this gets complicated pretty fast. Those of us who were here spent a lot of time trying to understand these issues, and there's a lot of wheels turning inside it. Representative Johnson, you had something else.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. And Skip, I didn't know if you wanted to make a pitch for the TAO event after hours tonight, but I'll just...
Happy to.
You touched on a few. You made some comments about the conversation and how other states are considering similar topics and so forth. And, you know, and I think it was Joan, maybe you mentioned the need for a consistent framework as it relates to tax policy and as it relates to industries like technology and so forth. But I guess my question would be to either one of you, what can you tell us about how this conversation is being approached in other states? Okay, sometimes I think one of the things we do in Oregon, we get wrapped up in this bubble up here, and we don't oftentimes see what some of our neighbors are doing, and then we wonder at the end of the day why our per capita incomes don't look very good compared to some of them. Mm-hmm. So I just like to know what other states, you know, it's a big question, obviously, it's not limited to Oregon, but are other states actively pursuing incentives, or are they having a different, you know, there's a different mindset to relate to this. And one could be punitive, trying to say, we're not so sure we like you being that successful. The other could be, we want to put in place mechanisms that encourage you to come here, invest, so that we can continue to have what the industry needs as technology explodes. We've got to have bandwidth so you all can be connected and, you know, R&D and marketing and all that kind of stuff. So what can you share in a general sense, not going real deep, but what are other states doing on this topic?
Sure. Representative Johnson, Chair, members of the committee, there's a number of states that are looking at infrastructure of this type is critical to not only attracting companies, but I think also more importantly, people. And so whether you're talking about access to homes, as technology workers are increasingly working more remotely, I mean, we have examples in Hood River and Central Oregon and southern parts of the state where there's a large concentration of remote tech workers that can choose to live wherever they want, and they choose to live there because of a high quality of life. And a big part of it is their connectivity. So whether it's some space that they access in the form of a small office or whether it's a home office, connectivity is a key part of that, as much as a good quality of life is an attractive competitive advantage. So you look at a lot of the Western states, many of them are growing because of this exodus from major established tech hubs, and people are looking for a relatively low cost of living, high quality of life, and connectivity to access whatever technology services they need to get connected to their teams and the rest of their colleagues. And so as you think of how states are looking to incentivize this type of investment, you know, those states in the West, as we looked at the study, we said, okay, what are some of the ones that are currently doing something around central assessment, and how's their treatment of intangibles? And Arizona was one that essentially said, okay, let's just forget about the intangibles piece. That's just too complicated, too messy. We're going to take that part off the table. We then had a number of other states. I think it was Texas, off the top of my head, Utah, and maybe Washington, that have some series of tools that they apply to allow some sort of either exemption or mitigation of taxation of intangibles under central assessment. And so it's a recognition on the part of those states that this is critical infrastructure, and, you know, being able to at least attract that type of investment is going to be critical. And it's a multiplier effect because it impacts companies and the people that rely on that service and that technology infrastructure.
Great.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, I'll just add, I'm from Washington State, and I'm new to TechNet. This is my first year with TechNet, so a lot of my experience is within Washington State, and I can tell you that right now there's conversations going on up there on how to further access. And Washington is very similar to Oregon in that we have a side of the state that is very rural and a side of the state that's very urban. And you have the Puget Sound sector that is very advanced in terms of our technology companies and industry. And what we're looking at now in Washington is how can a startup in Richland and in the Tri-Cities still have the same access to the types of services like broadband and the speed that is needed that the companies in Seattle and the more urban Puget Sound have. So it's continuing to, I can tell you in Washington, it's continuing to look forward and realizing that the state is in a race with the rest of the country on this.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Skip, I think you were the person who's noted that Oregon is 15th in the states in high-speed broadband. How is that measured?
Yep.
How do you get to that number?
Yeah, so the number was specifically, let me see if I can pull my notes here. I think it was measured as 100 megabits per second, and what it looked at for that research was a specific form that's required of telecommunications providers. The FCC requests that they submit information about type of service and who's being served in each of the different states. So Oregon was 15th, and then I believe Washington was first, California second. Mm. So it's from 2016, the data is from 2016, and high-speed broadband is defined as broadband speeds over 100 megabits per second. And the research was looking at Form 477 data. And so each carrier fills that out, gives it to the FCC to provide insight into who's being served in each state and how. And so that was the basis for for that ranking.
So is
please
follow up. So is this in percent of the population served by? I mean, did all those numbers add up, and then you get a percent of the population that's served by high-speed broadband, or how does this parse out?
Yeah. So what I can do, it's there's actually a site on the FCC site that goes into detail about the different components of the form 4777, mm-hmm. and happy to share that along with some of the data on some of the other reports that were referenced.
Thank you.
Yep.
Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I don't think anybody on the committee believes that Oregon ought to be disadvantaged when it comes to allowing and encouraging companies to provide high-speed internet in the urban areas, in the rural areas, to businesses, to private individuals. The issue here is the richness of the tax break and the need for it. I expect all businesses who enjoy a tax break of any kind to claim that it's valuable and necessary. What we need, however, is data that establishes that, and so far we haven't received any. So that's just a comment to all who are hoping to continue to enjoy a tax break like this one. We need data to explain why it is that this tax break is absolutely essential for you to get the job done in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jody Weiser and Marcia Kelly, please.
I stole your word. Enjoy. You're influencing me.
Jody Weiser, speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. When we were sitting in this room last Thursday, I started Googling Comcast rates, Oregon, Comcast rates, Washington, Comcast rates, California. I did about 20 states. The ad was exactly the same in every state, $59.99, except for Florida, where it was $39.99. So I think we need to explore why the customers in Florida get such better rates. We have no evidence that tells us that they get slower service or something. And so I think there's a lot of research there that needs to be done, not by the businesses who want the tax break, but by the customers who want the services. I do know that while we were meeting in 2015, fiber was being laid in Southeast Portland. Without the bill having passed, fiber was being laid. I know that I received an offer for 2 gigabit service at my home, and there has been no fiber laid recently in the neighborhoods near me. There are some new neighborhoods, but they're 5 to 3 years old, and nothing has been, they've been digging up no old streets to put fiber in. So I imagine fiber was put in for those homes when they were built. So I don't think we should assume that because we're told the investments were made because of the tax break, that that's the actual truth. I think that some of the questions you raised, Rep. Barnhart, speak to that point. I can remember when we communicated in three ways, in person, on a party line where you waited for the people to get off, and by mail. And there have been massive changes since then. I can find no evidence that we changed the way we taxed communications companies until 2000 and either it's 2000 or 2001, I don't remember. But we made a little change then, and then we made big changes in 2015. All those infrastructure improvements happened without changes. The companies that are asking you for a tax break built their infrastructure knowing what our tax system was, and they made the choice to come to Oregon. So I don't think we should assume that the only thing we can do is race to the bottom with other states and lowering our taxes, because that's obviously what they want, but it doesn't mean that we won't get their services without that change. We think that 2770 is the better of the two bills before you. because it simply ends one of the tax breaks that you passed in 2015, and the infrastructure was obviously happening before you passed it, and it'll continue to happen. And we've never seen the charts that you seem to remember, Rep. Nose, that showed that, in fact, we were charging a whole lot higher taxes than other states. And so I wonder whether that is totally accurate or not, because it certainly was never part of public testimony. So I would be interested in seeing that. We do know that from the bills that were passed in 2015, a subsidy that in 2013-15 was costing $17.5 million is now expected to cost $42.3 million. So the changes you made are costing us a day of school a year, basically, costing us $25 million. And that's a day of school. And so we really have to ask ourselves, is that speed that we may or may not get with or without this tax break is really essential. There isn't really any evidence that the customers of Oregon received any benefit from the $25 million tax break. So what purpose did it serve? And we wonder if you shouldn't undo all of what you did in 2015 rather than only the gigabyte portion. But I would say you have limited the amount that they will pay on intangibles with the law you've passed. You've already done that. The gigabit server part just eliminates it entirely. It's limited with the other portion of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, Marcia Kelly for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. I don't believe that the gigabyte tax credit is necessary to obtain service, high-speed service in Oregon. And I will point to an example of the press release from Frontier from 2015. It came out about a month after the bill was signed by the governor in the middle of May of 2015. And they were pointing out their investments in Oregon in the prior 3 years, 2012, 13, and 14. And on that, I've copied this because I found it on their corporate page. They point out that they're launching a 1 gigabyte service for residential FIOS customers in specific neighborhoods in Beaverton. These were accomplished by 2014. So having a bill in 2015 that's going to incentivize them to provide service that they're already planning on providing seems a little bit disingenuous to me. Likewise, Comcast has said that they're going to be providing high-speed service, and they don't necessarily say, but we're only going to do it if Oregon gives us this tax break. I don't believe that people will move to Oregon only because they have this tax break. I believe that people will move to Oregon because the cost of living is less expensive than the Bay Area. The quality of life is hopefully going to retain its status, but as we give tax credit and tax credit and tax credit away, we are taking away education, human services, and public safety funding that help the quality of life in Oregon. This bill, I don't believe, is necessary to provide high-speed internet service to those folks who want it but don't need it. And I think that the market will provide high-speed internet access to those companies like gaming companies who require it for their business because it's a business expense. They can deduct it from their taxes.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2063 and House Bill 2770. It looks to me like everybody's here. We'll open a work session on the introduction of committee bills. As noted before, the introduction of bills by the committee is as a courtesy. It is not intended to bind anyone to support or vote for the bill later, simply a way of getting a bill in front of the legislature. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move that the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills: LC 2060, dated 2317, and LC 3809, dated 2217.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves LC 2060 and LC 2809 be introduced as committee bills. Discussion. Representative Vance, please.
Mr. Chairman, do we know who introduced the bills to, or are the bills, do they have some way of attributing those bills to whoever suggested them?
Good question. I don't know. It's possible.
At the request of?
Well, of course, both of these bills are drafts are listed in OLIS, so you could look at them. The first one has to do with disclosure of corporate excise and income tax returns to the chairpersons and vice chairpersons of legislative committees relating to revenue.
It's not mine. It sounds like yours.
It does, but it's not mine.
It isn't yours. Okay. And the second one refers to a wholesale sale of inhalant form nicotine, having to do with licensed retailers.
It could be me.
Yeah.
Cigarettes or vaping?
Both. Any other questions?
Oh, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes, please.
Well, if someone's willing to take responsibility for the bills, then in keeping in mind the decade-old or more approach to not supporting the bill, then I would join everyone in, or not everyone, join those who support them as committee bills in voting yes, but without direct attribution, I'll be voting no.
Thank you. Other discussion?
I'm looking to see what's
saying.
Let me simply note for the in this conversation, this is, for those of you who haven't been here before, this is not a new conversation. Simply note that bills that are introduced in, by the committee go through the same process as bills that are introduced by individual members in terms of being referred to the speaker's desk, referred by the speaker for first reading, referred then by the speaker to committees depending upon the subject matter of the bill. And then, of course, the committee process is entirely transparent, open as of, for the public hearings that you've already heard. Bills have a long way to go before they become law. And every single bit of that process, of those processes after this stage, is entirely open to the public. Any further discussion? Yes, Representative Buehler, please.
Yeah. Chair, I certainly agree with all that, but I think there's a certain reputational risk that the legislature is undertaking here by allowing such bills that haven't had thorough vetting get to this point, and I think that needs to be considered by all members of the legislature.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I would argue that what we do in this building is we vet bills. Bills are introduced and then we vet them.
Yes. Yes, please. Go ahead.
Follow up. And I think as we've all experienced here recently, this process takes a fair amount of time and resources, especially with the legislative council. And when we plug up the process with a lot of bills that no one's willing to take responsibility for, other bills that are supported by a large number of legislators then get stuck. And I think we need to think about that, the number of these bills coming through.
Thank you. Representative Johnson?
2 points, Mr. Chair. First, in our environment committee, as you well know, we had the opportunity to vote on committee bills last week, and the chair was able to get us attribution for those bills, and we were able to send those bills on through. So there's a different process that could shed some light on where these measures are coming from. But secondly, it's as yes, you mentioned that there will be a transparent process later on, but I've personally responded to more emails in my office, I think, than I can recall in my four terms to bills that people assume I'm supporting because they are House revenue bills. And so until there is some sort of ownership of those measures simply by virtue of being a measure of the committee, there's a large segment out there that assume I support everything that obviously they don't understand the process very thoroughly. Right. But my point is my staff and I have taken a lot of time just simply saying, not our idea, not our bill, and having to go through those hoops. So.
Yes, and I think you're referring to two specific.
There were some more this weekend.
Were there some more? Yeah. Oh, okay, something I didn't know about. All right. I would simply note that this is a process that we've been using, as I understand it, since 1967. Before that time, as my understanding is that pretty much anybody in the state could introduce a bill in the legislature, and then it was limited, I think probably because of the development of our legal staff, simply not having the capacity to handle all those bills that came from outside. At least since 2001, this committee has followed the practice we're following now. Nothing new there. And I would disagree respectfully with those who suggest that it clogs up the works. The reality is that bills have great hurdles to climb over before they even get to a hearing, as those who want hearings in the committee know. And then having done that, they still have to get past the public hearing and the vetting of bills by the committee as they proceed. I know it may be a value judgment, but I value very much the idea that bills should be introduced that nobody knows for sure whether they really present a good idea or not until they go through that public vetting process. And Representative Shetterly, when he was chair of this committee, had that value, the Republican. I certainly have that value. Some bills that look unusual at first blush turn out two sessions later to be the thing that the legislature adopts because they work. If we insisted on attribution on every bill, those bills would never be introduced in the first place. Are there further discussion? Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually can concur with much of the statements you're making. For me, there's a higher politic right now that is playing out with me personally.
Yes.
And so I'll be a no on both these initially, but I want you to know I'm getting a little nervous about having my vote being dictated by politics, and so I want you to know I'll be playing that out today, but in the future I reserve to keep my vote independent.
Thank you, and I think if I could put words in your mouth, you're going to consider the bills we introduce on their merit, regardless of how you vote today.
Most definitely, Chair, but I have to associate with some of the words from Rep. Smith Warner that part of this process is allowing bills to be vetted out and both the good and the bad. But again, there's a higher politic playing out today.
At the moment, thank you. Other comments? I think we better call the roll. The question is on the introduction of LC drafts 2060 and 2809. Those in favor will say aye. Those opposed, no. When your name is called, please.
Representative Buehler.
No.
Representative Fernandez.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Marsh.
Yes.
Representative Nose.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
No.
Vice Chair Smith Warner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz.
No.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. Motion carries. Bills will be introduced. We'll close the work session on bill introduction. And let me get back to my list here. My understanding is we're not ready on the work session on 2279. Is that right, Paul? We haven't heard back yet from the Speaker's office on what we understand, just so you'll know, is that on 2279 there doesn't appear to be a fiscal, and yet it has a reference to Ways and Means. Mm-hmm. And we may be able to move that. With the Speaker's agreement, we may be able to take that off. So we're going to hold that over, the work session over till tomorrow for House Bill 2279 in hopes that we hear from the Speaker's office by that time. And we'll open the information meeting then on the background report on nonprofit property tax exemptions. Yeah, okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, up next we have, or what I'll be presenting today is just going over some of the interim work that our office was doing this past, actually for about a year and a half, 2 years now. But what we put together was a little background, or, well, it's not little, it's about 80-something pages.
81.
Okay. So it's a background document on a topic of discussion that's been ongoing for more than just a couple of years, but in some ways it adds some background to some interim work that's been going on with a work group, a legislative work group as well. Members, two members from the House Revenue Committee and two members from the Senate are part of this. Representative Vents being the remaining Revenue Committee member on the House side, Representative Leininger as well, and then Senators Boquist and Riley. But the work was looking into property tax exemption for literary, charitable, and scientific organizations with the idea of trying to provide a little bit of history for some context, and then also during some of the interim updates, what's been described as a really unpacking of the exemption. So this property tax exemption, as the name suggests, it's a fairly broad exemption. So it includes nonprofit organizations, charitable, and then also has some of the literary and scientific. Those are smaller parts. For the most part, it is a charitable exemption. But it can group in a lot of different nonprofits doing a lot of different things. So charitable is a pretty broad term that can include social welfare organizations. In some cases, there is some, we've seen some low-income housing, although there's other statutes available for those as well. And then it can also range up to such things as the healthcare nonprofits or hospital nonprofits as well. So it's a really broad category. What's not included, just to hit that real quick, is religious organizations are under their own statute, so they're not included, so there's no information on them in the report. And education, for the most part, is in their own statute as well. So there might be some education that touches on this, but if you're thinking private universities, they're also not included here. So what I plan to do today is I'll try to just step through the report. At the risk of disincentivizing you all from reading it, I will just hit the chapters and maybe spend 15 seconds on describing what's in there, what the takeaway is, and then I'll spend a few minutes on this unpacking part, because that really represents new information that is not necessarily really available prior to this document. There was some work done by the Department of Revenue that did a little bit of a snapshot view of a 1 year, and I'll touch on that as well. But in a lot of cases, it's talking about the various court cases throughout Oregon's history to give some context for how we got to where we are today. Because in many cases, the exemption and its structure is informed by case law. The statute itself predates statehood for Oregon. And you can actually track it back, even all the way back to, I think it was Sumerian times as well, in some cases. So it's a long-standing exemption in some ways. Okay. So working through the report, and this is up in OLIS. It's just under the general meeting materials.
I'm pretty sure that's before I was born.
All the way back to Samaria. That's fascinating.
In some ways, Mr. Chair, yeah, there has been some slight development in nonprofits over that time as well.
Since the cuneiform was used, is there
that's about 3,000 BC, isn't it? 5,000 years ago, rough numbers.
Yeah. Sure, I didn't track it back that far. I just thought it was a good line, but. Yeah, so the history of the exemption and the historic development and justification, the history, again, this in some ways has followed even back to European times. So there's been an exemption. It wasn't necessarily for nonprofit organizations. In a lot of cases, it traces back to religious organizations, which were the first. But so this exemption really has been longstanding, and there is an exemption available on the federal level in both the corporate income tax, but the property tax is actually the one that predates in a lot of ways. But so what I covered here was just some of the basic history, and then there's also primarily two justifications, if you will, for the reason for the exemption. And one is base definitional, and the idea behind that is just saying nonprofits aren't part of the property tax base. So it's an exemption, and it's included in reports and such, just the way that the statute is structured. But the intent wasn't to ever include these things to begin with. And again, I should say this is more of just a summation of what's out there in the literature discussing this. The report isn't trying to take a side and saying this is why it should be this way or this is why it should be that way. And the second major discussion point is the subsidy. And that is the state is actively giving a subsidy to these types of organizations. And one of the justifications for that would be, in many ways, nonprofit organizations do work that supports the state, or absent the actions of the nonprofit organization, the state would be required to absorb some of that burden. But those are the two primary rationales, if you will, for the exemption. One thing just to note is there is federal tax-exempt status. So in some ways, Oregon's property tax exemption is tied to the nonprofit being like a 501c3 at the federal level. It's not necessarily a requirement that you could be something outside of a 501c3 and still receive exemption if you meet the specifics in Oregon law. But for the most part, it's going to be if you're exempt at the federal level, you have the opportunity of then being exempt from your property taxes, but it's not a guarantee. I won't go through this table, just something to highlight would be Exhibit 2-1. One of the discussions that came up with the work group over the summer was just what is the definition of charity? And it's not something that's easily defined. I included a couple sources that are referenced that just give some idea of what is charity defined as. But just for your reference or taking a look at it a later time. The administration of the property tax exemption, the important thing here is it is at the assessor level. So it's the county assessor's responsibility to receive the applications for exemption and process these exemptions. And that's important because there are 36 county assessors. So that's 36 different counties that, if something's ambiguous, may be trying to identify the way in which to determine whether this property is exempt or not. And that's one of the discussion points. The assessors have certainly been before this committee and the Senate Finance and Revenue expressing that there is some ambiguity in the law and does make it difficult to know whether or not exemption exists. And with the county, each county assessor doing the determination, you can end up in areas, fully legitimate areas, where one county thinks it is exempt and another county does not. And part of that is just it works its way through the process, the judicial process, and then you have a new precedent from which to work from. And then DOR does have some oversight role, but it really is a county assessor role in this case.
Do we have any examples, current examples of that conflict you were just describing between different counties?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, one of the ones that came up before this committee, I believe it was in the 15, maybe the 16 session, was Habitat for Humanity was an example where you had different counties treating it slightly differently. And then there was a legislative change that went through the legislature to try to attempt to resolve that. And then shortly after that change, of course, it worked its way through the courts finally, and the exemption was found in favor of Habitat for Humanity. So that's an example where there was disagreement between the county assessors, and you can either wait for the judicial process to work its way through or attempt to do it legislatively.
Habitat for Humanity provides homes for ownership by low-income individuals, as I recall.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And the confusion there was even the timing of it. If they purchased the land, but they weren't building the home at the time, or when does the exemption kick in, when does it not? And that was part of the issue.
Representative Ellis?
So just to follow up, so the issue was not that they didn't qualify. It was more the technicality of administering it, right? I mean, they seem like a nonprofit to
here,
me.
Here. That wasn't the question.
Yes, Representative Nose. Trying to remember the exact court case. I believe it's Methodist Homes versus Department of Revenue, but it does talk about in one of the case law that's set up, taxation is the base, and then exemption is the exception. So if there is ambiguity, the idea is that you would fall on denying the exemption. Mm-hmm. It's really on the burden of the person applying for it to receive it. So in that case, there can just be an interpretation where a county may just say, I'm going to deny it just so we know whether or not we should be accepting this anyway.
Interesting.
And some of the testimony that's been received is even just some of the smaller counties don't necessarily have the resources to work through the judicial process. So they may just say, yes, it's exempt, and then it falls in some cases to some of the larger counties to deny it and actually work it through the courts.
Okay.
So because resources are available
exactly,
to the county.
True. Yes.
Right. Please go ahead.
Okay. So yeah, there is kind of a sampling of the major court cases, and that's whenever an issue would come up, you'll see five or six of the same court cases described that really lay out the general framework, and then it gets down to the specifics of what's in front of them based on that nonprofit setup and what they're trying to do and what they're trying to exempt. So just quickly, and I think this is one the committee has seen this chart before, but it sets up the general structure of the exemption, and it really is, it's a two-part test. And the first one is you ask, is the entity a charitable institution? And the second part is the property actually and exclusively occupied and used in the charitable work?
Right.
So to the discussion, Representative Nosis, you were asking about, you can be a nonprofit, and then it depends upon your use of the property on whether or not you qualify. Because one of the things that certainly comes up, if you're using the property in a way that doesn't support directly your charitable act, like say you have a retail store can be a bad example in some cases, but if you're just running a gym or something to that effect, and there's nothing about the way you're running your gym membership that is charitable necessarily, you're just using the funds to support your other work, in that case the gym probably wouldn't qualify, because it's the use of the property having to be a charitable use.
This gets tricky. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson, please.
So, in my mind, this gets very tricky because sometimes a nonprofit will run a sort of for-profit looking entity in order to create a revenue stream to underpin some other aspect of their, you know, like selling a T-shirt, you know, at way above cost, right, to create a pipeline for money to come into for a donation or a salary, you know, I mean, it's tricky. Like every hospital runs a gift shop. You know, you would not think it's the main source of revenue for the hospital, but for certain it's, you know, it probably has to make money to at least justify its existence in the building, you know.
Yes, and Chair Barnhart, Representative Nose, I should say everything that I'm going to say here, there's probably an exception to it as well. but those type of discussion topics do come up, the gift shop. And in a lot of cases, those can be exempt. Sometimes they're not. Is it going to support that? You can really get into that discussion where if a person's visiting a sick relative, is it helpful for them to be able to go down and purchase balloons and bring it up? And it's like there's an argument to be made that enhances the healing process or something to that effect. So you can see where as you get in the details, it gets difficult.
The OMSI food court, right? You know, you go to OMSI to experience science, you know, and you're there for a day, like I used to do with my little kids, and it'd be nice to be able to get a snack or coffee so I can endure it.
Yes.
Okay, so moving on to... getting away from that a little bit, but what I'll go through here is a series of tables that actually shows some of the output, and this really gets to the unpacking of the exemption, if you will. So the number that we have right now and what's in the governor's tax expenditure report is one large number for the entire exemption, and that's the way it gets reported by each county. So it's hard to tell sometimes how this actually breaks down. A couple notes up front. The information that we use to make these estimates, and I guess that'd be the first point, is these are estimates. They're in tables. They look like they're actuals, but they are all estimates. And they're based upon data in large part received by county assessors. And in the property that's being discussed here, because it's an exemption, this is exempt property. So one thing that was definitely stressed to us from the county assessors that were that shared the data with us and allowed us to do some of this analysis is it's important to keep in mind that the real market value of the piece of exempt property may not receive the same level of assessor time in placing that value because the property is exempt. So they do prioritize with accounts that are taxable. Whether or not the real market value on an exempt piece of property moves up or down, it doesn't affect the tax imposed because there's no tax imposed. So these really should be viewed as order of magnitude estimates for certain. Okay, I'll see if I can make this a little bit. But so what our office did is we received quite a bit of information from a number of counties. We didn't receive a full response from all of Oregon's 36 counties, but we received, I believe, is about 98.5% of all the value of exempt property using other data sources to compare that. So there was a few of the smaller counties that we didn't receive information from. but for the most part, we have every all the big counties. So it is a pretty good representation of the statewide figures. But what our office does, we attempted to categorize the nonprofits based upon what it is the nonprofit does. And in some ways, we use some of the work that was done by Department of Revenue a couple of years ago in a survey they sent out. But I say this in some ways because there's plenty of cases where a nonprofit could exist in multiple categories. And we just try to do our best based upon the information provided on their website or in their application or something to that effect to categorize these based upon that. And there are a number as well that are in, we do have a category, non-assigned. And that was just cases where, because we don't actually, there's not a category that exists for these things, there's a number that are not assigned, mostly because I didn't want to be too mean to our summer intern in making him Google search all this. But we did take a look at the higher value ones. So the non-assigned, why the number of unique property owners is almost 1,100. The value is about, I think it came to 5% or so, 4%. That's not assigned. That's still there. So it's a lot of the smaller nonprofits just get grouped in there. But so the chart we're looking at here, you have the nonprofit categories, the number of unique property owners. It should be noted this unique property owner is even a higher level number than what would actually be expected. And in some cases, this could be just because of the naming structure being different and hard time for us to identify whether it's all owned by one nonprofit. But also, there are a number of nonprofits that, where you might think of it, it's one nonprofit, they have a different technically nonprofit set up in each county or something to that effect. So in that way, the number can actually go up, and we would count those individually because they are putting in a single application, a single IRS 990 form and such. But so we've listed the general government loss and shift. This is similar to what you'd see in a revenue impact statement, and then split out the education loss and shift. So just as a reminder, the shift represents the dollars that are attributed to bond levies. So these are not lost dollars. They're just shifted to other property tax owners. So the actual loss is just in the loss column.
And you because the denominator is smaller, the rate that other taxpayers have to pay goes up, and they pay more.
Precisely, it's true.
On the shift.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So you can see the overall revenue loss was estimated at about $122 million. And this is for the 15-16 fiscal year or tax year on the property tax side as well.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Chair Barnhart. I have a question. For the categories of nonprofit, does those include charities in that category? Like, are there social welfare? Are they 100% all charity organizations?
Rep. Hernandez, these are all ones that they do qualify for exemption. In terms of charity, they could be included there. I'm not sure.
Okay. So just to clarify, follow up, Mr.
Yes, Chair. Please, Representative Hernandez.
So I ran a nonprofit, 501c3, full tax exempt. 100% of what we did was services. Does that mean that 100% of every single one of these exempted properties also provide services to that extent, or is there a threshold?
No, Representative Hernandez, it would include both or multiple types. So that is one thing to see. You could foundations or something in effect where they're primarily based upon donations is where their funding comes from, and then they disperse that back out and maybe grants or services or something to that effect. They're included here the same as those type of institutions that are maybe more fee-based. And that's the example, and definitely the largest one you can see there is like something like a hospital, where most of the revenue coming into a hospital is coming in from fee for service, not from donations or something to that effect. So it would include both, or I don't even know if I'd say it as both, but it's definitely grabbing that whole broad grouping of nonprofits there.
And is there, like, do they have to meet a minimum standard to get that exemption?
Please.
Yeah. Great question.
Representative Hernandez, that's part of what's in case law. It talks about, in some cases, quantified figures, but that's not in statute. So it's hard. There's nothing that would require, say, 6% of your revenues must go directly out to a certain group of individuals or something to that effect. There is a requirement of a gift or giving, so there does have to be some of that. But you can, if I'm understanding maybe the larger question or the point, is you can have nonprofit organizations that look quite a bit different from one another, both under this exemption structure.
Okay.
Where you can think a social welfare or a food bank or something to that effect, and then some of these other ones that are operating substance abuse or something treatment, operating quite a bit differently. They'd be a nonprofit, but they could have maybe 4 or 5% of their total revenue goes to low-income individuals at no cost or something to that effect that allows them to qualify.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please. Last one. Hernandez.
So is there, in this report, is there that type of data where I could look at, like, a return on investment, for example, for whether it's in my district, if they are getting a tax property exemption, whether that return on investment is really worth it for our local community? Are we receiving more charitable services compared to the tax break we are giving?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Hernandez. To that level, no, there's not. I'll be going through a later chapter that talks about using some of the IRS 990 data, which is a form the nonprofits have to fill out, to look at things where they have to report, a nonprofit have to report program service revenue and expenses and some of that. But part of that chapter is really just designed to show that that type of analysis can't really be gleaned from that data. Because there's so many, one, because nonprofits are set up in so many different ways that just using high-level categories can be difficult to get there. But that cost-benefit, it would not, no, we don't have a database or something to that effect where we could pull a nonprofit and say, here's their exemption amount, and here's the services they're providing.
So, sorry, one, it made me think of this question. Can we separate those that are nonprofit from charities to see, you know, what are those organizations that fully dedicate themselves to giving 100% to the people that they serve, and those that partially provide a charitable percentage, whatever that percentage may be, so that we can distinguish those two from each other? Is that desegregated in this report?
No, Representative, it is not, and that information is not provided or required in that form to receive the exemption. It's again that the IRS 990 is probably your best source of data, similar to something to that effect. And even that, and I'll elaborate upon this a little bit later on, is it's not, the structure of the data that's available doesn't really allow a great analysis in that way either. Now, the exception, and I'll touch on it as well because I have some tables a little bit later, hospitals might be a better example of how that is provided, because there's different requirements for them through Oregon Health Authority, where they do talk about their charitable level of charitable care, community benefits, and such. But the way the exemption is structured right now, those questions are not asked or, I guess, followed or kept in a database or anything out of effect.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. I think Representative Hernandez asked a really insightful question with regards to correlating the property tax exemption to the return that the taxpayers in Oregon are receiving from that exemption. Has there ever been any thought with regards to at least I know analyzing the return would be difficult, but at least a threshold of criteria to qualify for the exemption and what that might look like?
Representative Bueller, I think there are some pieces of legislation that are certainly have been introduced in this body this time. On the Senate side right now, there is a bill that's being discussed that's about an information return that would include a little bit more information that would be required to be submitted that would be an annual return. So it'd be an annual, when you're attempting to request the exemption, you would include some of that information. From a historical standpoint, I don't know if there's been a lot of push to try to get some hard figures included in that. The way the exemption's structured right now, or the application for it, it's a one-time application. So you apply for the exemption, and then so long as the property doesn't change ownership hands or anything to that effect, you continue to receive it.
So a nonprofit that had an excessively high administrative cost, for example, could still qualify for the property tax exemption.
Yes, Representative Buehler, there is, and it's in the report. I can't remember what page it's on at this time, but there was some a bill that went through related to the Department of Justice in some ways, limiting, I think it's to 75% or something of that effect. Some of those charities that are just exceedingly high overhead. And if you were on that list of charities that don't qualify for the, in this case, it was for the personal income tax deduction as a charitable deduction, if they don't qualify for that, they wouldn't qualify on the property tax side. The exception in that case, though, are nonprofits that are predominantly fee-based. Because in that case, if you're predominantly a fee-based one, it would be perfectly, I guess, expected or it's commonplace where 95% of your expenses are to something like overhead in that way, and 3.5% is charity, community benefit, that effect.
Yeah. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I'm assuming you'll be getting to this because I'm sorry I haven't read this yet. Part of the idea behind the work group, too, I remember the assessors brought to us was the idea that hospital systems, for example, were purchasing practices that were in a building that had been a tax-paying, and then all of a sudden they're part of the hospital system, and so then they get taken off the tax rolls, and how do you, and with the ACA, which has, you know, decreased dramatically the amount of unpaid care, that was one of the things they were seeking some guidance on, that was part of this. Is that, am I remembering that right?
Yes, that, okay. Absolutely. Okay. Yes, that was one of the big discussion topics, certainly for the work group as well. And I should say that this document, in some way, is a companion to what the work group was doing, but it doesn't have any output of the work group or anything like that. It is strictly just a background document.
Okay. We're very clear on that in the intro.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to let you go on, but while I'm thinking about it, I want to just ask that you, if you can, prepare just a short schedule that describes all the different bases in Oregon property tax law for being tax exempt. And if you know, or if you can find out quickly, what the relative values of those are. I mean, for example, here you're dealing with a particular category, a particular statute. There are other statutes that apply to religious organizations and things of that sort. There may be others, too, that I'm less familiar with. I think for a purpose of orientation, oh, you've already got it. Okay. All right. And then I'm ahead of us. Thank you.
He's got 81 pages.
He's got, yeah, 81 pages should be able to answer.
He knows what's on every page.
Yeah. And why the universe exists all should fit within 81 pages.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I buried it in the appendix, but it is the first appendix.
It is there.
But this is a listing of all the nonprofit property tax exemptions. And again, these are the exemptions structured towards a nonprofit. A nonprofit could be receiving some other type of exemption as well, but these are ones that are tailored to nonprofits. And this is based upon the 1719 Governor's Tax Expenditure Report of these revenue loss figures. And you can see at the top is this 307-130 exemption at $190.7 million per year, followed by religious organizations, and then you child care facilities, schools, and student housing. So that's education in a lot of cases.
But those are references to specific statutes that authorize those exemptions.
Yes.
Great. Thank you. That's very helpful. That's table one. While we're still on table one, let me then ask the question that comes up exhibit 5-1A. It shows a loss of $122 million. On table one, it showed a loss of $190 million. What's the difference? Or maybe I'm just misreading the table. Who knows?
Mr. Chair, some of the difference between what's here and what's in the Governor's Tax Expenditure Report, there's two reasons. Well, there's more than just even two reasons, but one is source of the data. So even though the Tax Expenditure Report is based upon county data, we did see a couple instances where a county reported, perhaps didn't report a zero on the number that they sent in that's used for the Governor's Tax Expenditure Report, and they responded to our survey with figures. So, and they may have got, I mean, that's easy for those to get overlooked or lost in putting together the statewide figures. Another one is, for the analysis I did here, is I included an estimate on what the business personal property is. So that right there will inflate the figures, where the figures that are coming in and reporting the governor's tax expenditure report are based upon the real property, so the building itself. And then I took an attempt to estimate what it is of the property within those buildings, the business personal property that would be taxable.
Right.
So that's a piece that maybe isn't in the figures in the governor's tax expenditure report. So that's the largest, probably the largest reason why the numbers are larger.
You came up with the numbers in a different way, and therefore it's not surprising that they're different.
Yes, exactly.
That's very helpful.
Yeah.
Please go on, unless there are other questions on this point so far. Thank you.
Okay, and then the next set of exhibits I have here was just trying to display how the nonprofit exemption affects different areas of the state. Mm-hmm. So I have this by county, and again, there are a few missing counties there that we didn't have data for. But it's not, unsurprisingly, the largest by total loss is the largest counties: Multnomah, Lane, Washington, Marion, Clackamas counties. They're the largest populated. They have the most nonprofits. It makes sense that they have the largest estimated loss. But to get a sense of, in terms of their overall revenue as a percentage of, that's where the next two tables come in. And Exhibit 5-4, the red line here is the overall, as a percentage of the tax that was imposed, what's the estimated loss in the exemption. Mm-hmm. And you can see there's definitely some variation by counties. Multnomah County is pretty much right at the overall, hitting the statewide mark. Lane County, on the other hand, is much higher, closer to 5% instead of 2.1. And one of the things you'll you can pick out when you're looking at these, is when you see a county that's exceeding the statewide mark by quite a bit, you're going to find a large hospital or hospital conglomerate property there. And that's especially the case in some of the more rural areas, where it's dominated by, if they have a larger hospital complex there, that's going to move their exemption amount up.
That's
that Representative Nelson, please.
So that doesn't include like the University of Oregon or state forestry land. That is just private.
Right. Yes. Okay. Representative Nelson. Yeah. It doesn't include, and OHSU is not included. That's okay. Outside of the statute as well. And that's probably part of the reason Multnomah County looks a bit lower too, is you're not including OHSU.
Right. That is fascinating. I would like not today, but another time, a little more on that issue. My county is one of my counties is way off the map, and the other one is under the average. So, Lane and Lynn, be useful to get an idea of where that's coming from.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Rep Marsh, please, and then Rep Smith.
Well, just reflecting back on the two charts, the one earlier and then one in the appendix, it looks like they're simply that one is for a single year and one is for biennium. So I think that's maybe the difference and significant difference.
Ah, thank you. That, yes, back to a table or appendix one you're referring to. Thank you. That does make a lot of sense. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate this conversation. This has been really educational. Can you share with me, I missed it, why are certain counties missing off of this chart? I noticed Umatilla County's not on there.
No data.
Yeah, Representative, just didn't receive data back.
They didn't reply back.
Right. And to their credit, I should say, if you were a larger county and you didn't initially respond, I followed up sometimes numerous times. If you were a smaller county and you're not going to move the needle too much, they didn't receive the same follow-up from me. So
Representative Johnson,
Mr. Chair, Kyle, I haven't read the report in depth enough, but in higher ed, there are for-profit institutions. Are they classified separately, or are they pulled out of the sample just because they are offering degrees and certificates, but they are for-profit rather than nonprofit?
Yes, Representative Johnson, if they're for-profit, they're not going to be receiving the exemptions. They would not be included there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. The next chart that I would just draw attention to is an attempt to display the concentration. And really the takeaway here, there's a lot going on in the different categories, but it's just to see the concentration. You can see it's about 80% of the estimated revenue loss is derived from 7% of the exempt nonprofits. So that's, I show these for all the different categories, but you can just see the line to show. It's the larger nonprofits that, of course, have the most property and are moving the needle on the loss amount. So for most of these, it's going to be a pretty small figure, and then you have some nonprofits that own quite a bit more property or lease the property.
Mm-hmm. Okay. fascinating.
Okay. So then moving on to Exhibit 5, 56A. Spent a little bit of time, and this is in part through some of the bills that came up in the 2015 session and then some of the discussion that Vice Chair Smith Warner alluded to, is the nonprofit organizations related to, and for simplicity's sake, they're just titled hospitals here, they're health organizations, but wanted to dive down into a little bit of some of the information that's available. And part of this is also just this information is available because of different requirements passed in statute years ago that they have to report to the Oregon Health Authority. So this table here is a subset, again, it's a subset of the subset, really. But it's related to, it's based on the data that we have information for, and I was linking up the property tax exemption data that we received with Oregon Health Authority data to compare hospitals, the exemption they're receiving, with the level of charity care and then community benefits that they're providing. Those are generally the two figures that are thrown out there and discussed. Is charity care is a subset of community benefit as well. And per the discussion that the vice chair alluded to, this is a static figure. This is for the 15-16. Charity care can definitely move around. In recent years, it's been going down. Changes at the federal level to the ACA, of course, could cause that figure to start moving back up. So this is really a snapshot of what the charity care was for that year. But with some of the discussions, some of the legislation that's been introduced in the 15 session, and I think there's some out there as well for the 17, was if you try to set a threshold, a requirement of X amount of charity care or X amount of community benefit that a nonprofit hospital organization would have to meet to receive their property tax exemption, where would the chips fall, really? And that's what this table is trying to show. Now, of course, it's important to keep in mind that if a threshold limit was put in place, you're going to see a behavioral change for these nonprofit organizations, where if they can up their chair, if they need to go up 0.5% of their charity care to be fully exempt, they're probably going to do that if it makes a sense from a cost-benefit sense. So if their property tax exemption outweighs that difference in the required increase in charity care, they'll most likely do that. So I'm just trying to stress that these wouldn't be revenue impact figures or figures of how much revenue you would expect to increase if you made a change or requirement to that effect. But so just walking through the table really briefly, you can see there's about overall, and I have a cumulative percentage to give some sense of this. If you were to place, say, a line at must have charity care 1% or greater, right now you have 13 hospitals that are providing 1% or less, representing about 40% of the cumulative loss. So it just gives you some sense of how many hospitals are providing a certain level of charity care and how much really property they have, because that's a function of their exemption loss. And then the community benefit is following the same idea, but using just a different figure for what the hospital is providing.
Right.
Okay.
And just a note on it, one of the questions we've had, and it's in the paper as well, is you can see the number of hospitals is 41. That's less than the actual number of hospitals. That's for a few reasons. Some of them are district hospitals, so they're not exempt under the 307-130 language. And there's a couple for-profit ones as well. And then there is even, I think, an instance where we were having trouble lining up the data. But that's why it's not necessarily the full figure that you see.
Did you include in this list the ones that are separately supported by the state because so much of their patient mix is Medicare, Medicaid? Are they included in this list?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The only ones that are not included here would be the district hospitals, just because they're exempt under a different statute. But if you're a type A, type B, I guess like a rural critical hospital or something to that effect, they would be included here as well.
Okay.
So long as they're not one of the district hospitals, which there's definitely a lot of overlap there as well.
Right. So it includes the ones that we subsidize because they couldn't stay open otherwise.
With the exception of the district ones,
right,
would be the only. So there are a few of those that, and that's part of the reason they're not in this exemption to begin with is, yes, they're being subsidized as a district hospital.
Thank you. Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a 101 question.
I have a lot of those.
I'm trying to get my arms around the definition of cumulative. When I look at this, what does that mean, cumulative loss?
So that, Representative Smith,
It's simply adding, in this case, if you're sticking with the less than 1%, the 29.4 million plus the 8.6 divided by the 72.8. So that's, I'm adding up these two figures, and that'd be 40% of the total for those two columns. So when you go down to a third column, you're now including the three columns all the way up.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me. Thank you.
And if you move one column to the left, you can see the numbers he started with.
Right, right. That makes sense now. Thank you.
Reading tables in this committee is not easy.
Right, right.
It is very difficult, and any question about a table is in order all the time.
You know, the one thing I learned, Mr. Chair, in Ways and Means is if I have a question, chances are someone else out there might have the same question. Yeah. So just ask.
Thank you.
Thank you for your patience.
Representative Smith, my answer was actually incorrect as well. The two numbers you're summing is the 20.8 plus the 8.6 equals the 29.4.
I see that.
So okay. I misread my own table. So
I get it.
Yes.
So that even establishes my point even more, doesn't it?
I'm glad I'm here to help you.
Okay, so as I mentioned, Department of Revenue did put out a snapshot survey. So I have the survey results in here. They largely line up with what we saw looking for all the years back. So what DOR said was, well, for those exemptions you certified in 2015, explain to us what they were, categorize them, and that such. So we looked a little bit at the larger exemption environment. But one table I'll just draw attention to that's included is, one thing DOR did is ask assessors to categorize whether deciding whether the application received exemption or not, whether that was easy, moderate, or difficult to do. And the overall figures were about 71% were categorized as easy, 25% moderate, and 4% as difficult. Now, again, the discussion, some of the feedback we've heard is that 4% can take up quite a bit of time on their side. And moderate was generally meant someone, assessor staff, had to either maybe they called Department of Revenue to get some input there, or they had to do some searching on their own of the past case studies and to that effect. So it just gives some sense of the admin, I guess, workload. Okay. There is a section given a brief history of hospitals. And again, being that they're the largest category, it seemed worthwhile to go into some depth there. And this also hits on some of the larger discussion in the literature out there of just the development of hospitals and how they've changed over time. And it also helps to provide some background on how, where the friction has come from, if you will, in some cases of how, whether or not these types of organizations are receiving the exemption is. You've seen a lot of change in the nonprofit industry, not just hospitals, but they're used as an example here, but in all nonprofits in some cases. But the law maybe, in a lot of cases, hasn't changed all that much either. So you still have these broad ideas in the law, but there's been change in the nonprofit structure. So it's not maybe too surprising in some cases that these types of questions of what qualifies for exemption, does the gift shop qualify, those type of things are coming up and having to be wrestled with. To some of the questions you had, Representative Hernandez, earlier, did spend a little bit of time doing some analysis on the IRS 990 returns. So these are annual returns that have to be submitted by nonprofits to the IRS, and they contain quite a bit of information. In some cases, these can be 1,000 pages. In most cases, you're talking 30 to 60 or something to that effect. But I spent some time trying to look, well, could we just use the information on IRS 990s to inform what the assessors have been asking for in terms of bright lines for using for qualification of the exemption. And ignoring even all the tables and charts and everything that's there, the takeaway was you're going to have a really hard time doing that. which was, yeah, I was hoping for another outcome because then it'd be an easy solution. But what these charts here, the 8-3, A, B, and C, are meant to... They show the different categories and percentage of, say, like their contributions and grants makeup of their overall revenues. And so if you wanted to put in place, you'd say expenses have to be equal to a certain amount and have to be spent in this way at a certain percentage of your total expenses, what would that do? And when you start to look through it, it even using different categories, so putting all the social welfare organizations together and trying to put a bright line in there, wherever you place that, you could be slicing off 30% of the nonprofits that are there. Or 60% or something to that effect. So it's really hard to find some number that you could use that 95% are already reaching today.
That's the general takeaway on those, is it's just the publicly available information that's out there right now doesn't necessarily lend itself to a really easy solution. It doesn't mean you can't drill down. I don't want to say that that's a policy recommendation is not to use that, but it's just there's more work to be done, I suppose, in that area.
I like the way you've drafted the table and then these bar graphs, which contain the same information, I think, as the table.
Yes.
I think different people can read these things and more easily in one way or the other, and having them both, I think, is quite good. Makes it easier for everybody. Representative Hernandez, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For other, what does that mean, the green?
Representative Hernandez, other, well, as a couple, if it was placed in just the other category, and then we receive that information as other, but it's some of the smaller categories. I can't recall off the top of my head what they were, but it was a bit of a catch-all on quite a few of them.
It's not animals,
but it's in some ways I try to leverage some data that was available on the IRS as well, because there's some categorization there, and they have another category as well. So there's other categories in there, and there's also just other that's in there. So, but I can try to get that actually broken out more and let you know. And then just moving through, keeping with the same theme, these are box plots that are now following the same data from the table that was in the previous charts as well. But it just gives you an idea, if you were trying to put a line in there, you can see a little bit that there's no real, other than from, I guess, the distribution of other revenue category. For a few of these, you could draw a line in there, and you're going to only exclude maybe 60%, 80%, 90%, or the inverse of that, 10% or 15% or something to that effect of nonprofits that organize that are doing business today like this. But it makes it hard, where if you just try to put a line right through here, you could see you'd be cutting off quite a few of the nonprofit organizations.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hernandez, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. What if you, maybe this is a dumb question now that I think about it, but what if you remove those that don't charge any type of fee to participants or users from those that do?
Yes, Representative Hernandez, that could be definitely one way to try to slice it and categorize those. The work that we did was based upon what the nonprofit's output or attempt output is, and try to categorize them that way. But that would be certainly one way. I mean, you could just group a number of nonprofits together that fit that description and just know of the total how many are basically everything that comes in goes right back out or something like that. But one of the difficulties that we've come up with is just it'll be listed in the 990 return, and it'll talk about here's the dollars the nonprofit spent on salaries or something to that effect, or compensation for their workers, and that could look like a really high number. But if they're nonprofit, if they're set up to provide, say, counseling services or something to that effect to all low-income charitable individuals or something like that, it's hard to tell the difference between that and one that's also then going for fee-based or something of that nature. So it's there's ones you can see where if they're grant institutions, they take in money, they just send it back out as grants. That's a little bit easier to see. But otherwise, you really have to parse the nonprofit organization in some cases to know what is it that they do, and then look how they're structured and how they're spending the money.
Well, some aspects of some organizations, too, work differently. I'm on the board of an addiction treatment program that I've been on for a long time. When they do gambling treatment, the whole thing is paid for through the lottery. There are no fees. If you're dealing with a drug or alcohol addiction, individuals who can afford it are expected to pay for at least part of their treatment cost. And it's in the same organization, but different treatment purposes. I think that would be kind of difficult to manage. Did you have other questions?
No.
Okay. I would love to have an explanation of this chart that you're looking at right now. You've got looks like a range table, then you have a line across that, and then you have a triangle inside the line. Inside the line, what do those three symbols mean?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
It may be in the text, and if it is, you can skip the answer.
Well, it is in the text. Just a quick, it's a standard box plot. So the way it's set up is the box itself represents 50% of all of the distribution. So 50% of all the nonprofits in that category are in the box.
Okay.
And then each whisker has 25% on each side. The line itself, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, is the median where the mean is the little. It looks like I believe it's a rhombus. It's pretty
the small. Carrot.
But it gives some sense, yeah, of where these okay. fall. So if I just zoom in on one for an example, and this is distribution of salaries, compensation, employee benefits by category, and it's a percentage of the total. For right. the education, you can see on average it's about maybe 38%, but half or above 38%, because you get 25% of the total here, another 25% here. And half are below it, and that's where if you're setting a line in there, you'd almost have to set it at 5% to make it low enough to okay. allow all these to still qualify.
Thank you. Do you have much more to go? Because we have to be out of here in about 2 minutes so the next committee can meet. So if you do, what I'd prefer to do is hold it over and let you finish up
tomorrow.
Let you finish up tomorrow, and also hold over the business tax reform rather than trying to rush through. The last piece.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the last piece I have is just experience of other states. We can go into detail, but the big takeaway there is that all the other states have an exemption similar to this, and they struggle as well to do it. There's definitely some other things that can be discussed, but I don't know if we necessarily have to carry it over just for that.
Well, I would commend the report to your study. As I page through it, it looks like a full of information and quite useful. I do expect that we're going to deal with some bills that refer to this area, and so knowing what's in the report, I think will be very helpful. Will be very helpful when we get to those topics. And with that, we're going to assume that you're finished, but do expect lots of questions from committee members as they carefully peruse this report later.
This is just.
Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the information session on non-profit property tax exemptions. We're going to hold over till tomorrow the business tax reform additional material, and we've completed our agenda, so the committee is adjourned. Thank you.
Very interesting.